It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here with lots of security tales of woe, including 106 malicious Google Chrome extensions, the truth about Zoom end-to-end encryption, and then we'll talk about two massive flaws, one in more than 70 Netgear routers, the other in pretty much every IoT and embedded network device anywhere. And there's not much of a fix. It's all coming up next on Security Now. Security Now comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 772, recorded Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020, Ripple 20. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Roman. Skip the waiting room and awkward face-to-face. Get ED medication conveniently delivered to your door in discreet, unmarked packaging. Go to GetRoman.com/SecurityNow for your free online visit and free two-day shipping. And by ExtraHop. ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Get tips on securing and supporting remote access or check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/securitynow. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at one-fifth the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com. Enter the code SecurityNow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover you with privacy. We wrap you up in security. We pat you on the head and we put you to bed. And it's all
done. You out trembling.
Trembling, yeah. Actually, that's more like it. Here he is, the man of the hour, Steve Gibson of GRC.com. Hi, Steve.
Leo, great to be with you again. We have a rip-roaring show. It's titled for this Security Now 772, Ripple 20, which, this speaks to why we really don't want to have a technological monoculture, but lots of news. We're going to look at Microsoft's interesting decision to once again update Windows 7, but not with what you would expect. Not security, but with the Edge browser. We're going to look at Google's wholesale removal of 106 widely downloaded malicious Chrome extensions and what brought that to their attention. Microsoft's continuing drama over Windows 10 printing, not resolved yet, folks. A potentially critical remote code execution vulnerability in everyone's favorite VLC media player. An interesting move by, wait for it, Roskomnadzor, of course, Russia's media watchdog.
We're going to really have to get a Russian to pronounce that for us so we know how that goes.
Yeah, maybe. Although I'm having too much fun with it as it is. So, we also have Netgear taking up residence in the doghouse. Oh, goodness. Also, a new and startling record has been broken in DDoS attack size. We've also got a bit of a rata as a consequence of you and I discussing how long we've been doing the show last week. That created quite a kerfuffle over in GRC's SpinRight news group or Spin Security Now news group. I also have the anticipated announcement of a new piece of spin-off freeware from the SpinRight project. And then time remaining. Actually, no, we'll have time. We're going to examine the ripple effects, thus the name Ripple 20, of the mass adoption of an embedded TCPI stack that is found now, 23 years since its birth, to be horribly insecure and quite widely adopted across the embedded device industry. So, yeah, and we do have sort of a unique picture of the week for those who are curious.
Yes, I can't wait to show everybody. That will be fun. Good. I'm excited. We're going to have a great security now. Before we go on, though, I want to mention our sponsor. We have a couple of sponsors in this show, but this one's a very important one, kind of near and dear to my heart. It's a company called Roman, and I don't know if you've seen their TV ads. It was founded by a young guy whose father was a physician. And the story goes, the young guy in his 20s was all of a sudden suffering from erectile dysfunction, ED, and which he thought was a little weird. And it was hard for him to talk about it, as you might imagine, as always is. Fortunately, he and his dad had a good relationship. He mentioned to his father, and his father saw it as a warning sign, somebody that young with ED. And so he got him to the hospital. It turned out he had heart disease. I think he had a couple of surgeries. He's fine now, founded Roman, because he says he believes men need a place to go for medical care because, hey, let's face it, guys, the way we were brought up, no tears. It's hard to get a guy to go to the doctor. Has Lori ever tried to get you to go to the doctor? I've been a few times, right? Admit it. Yeah.
Now we have COVID-19, so that's the new excuse.
Yeah, you have a good excuse now. Yeah. Right. And you know, when you're young, you know, you hurt yourself. They say, rub some dirt on it. You know, walk it off, kid. You know, don't tears. So we learned this at a young age. But it really is important to get medical attention. So now is a good time in COVID-19 time to get attention from Roman. Because Roman is not embarrassing. They've built a digital platform that connects you with a doctor, real doctor, licensed in your state. And you do it from your house, from your home. It's literally a digital health clinic for men. And of course, ED is the way they started because a lot of guys, I mean, especially as you get older, you don't want to, this is not the kind of thing you want to go, hey, doc, or go to the pharmacist. Hey, what do you got? It's embarrassing. So Roman made it possible to do this easily, but now they've expanded. They do all sorts, not just sexual health, but hair and skin, dandruff, eczema. Daily health. They've got supplements for a variety of things, including prostate health. And you're talking, it's not just we're writing a script. These guys care. They're real physicians. Telemedicine is hot right now. And that's what this is. And you're going to talk to a real physician if it's appropriate. And that's very important. If treatment is appropriate for either, they can prescribe and send your medication right to your door. Free 2-day shipping. Also, the free online visit. You grab your phone, grab your computer, go to GetRoman.com/security now. You'll hear back from a U.S. licensed physician within 24 hours. Free follow-ups, unlimited. At any time you got a question, you call your doctor, they're there for you. You want to adjust your treatment plan, they're there for you. No commitments. You can cancel any recurring subscriptions at any time. I think this is a great idea, and it's something we guys need. Let Roman be your source of wellness. So if you're struggling with ED, no reason for shame, no reason for embarrassment, no reason to suffer. Stay home. You don't have an excuse now. Go to GetRoman.com/security now. Get that free online visit, free 2-day shipping. It's GetRoman, G-E-T-R-O, not R-O-A-M-I-N apostrophe. It's Roman, like Roman numerals, GetRoman.com/security now for a free online visit. And a free 2-day shipping. It's a great service. I've used it myself. I highly recommend them. And they're really nice guys. And it's frankly something we guys need. GetRoman.com/security now. On we go with the show, Mr. G.
So anyway, you were talking on Sunday on Twit. Yep. About your blog. And you showed everybody a picture of yourself.
In high school.
I'm not sure high school.
Yeah.
So my high school gang that I've referred to a couple of times, we've maintained a connection to each other, and we're in a group text. I was listening to you guys talking on MacBreak Weekly about group texting. And I thought, I'm in a couple of groups.
Nice.
Jim, who was my best friend at the latter half of high school, and so when we both got into Berkeley, we requested each other as roommates, and he became my roommate, is in the process of digitizing his vast paper printed photo collection back from, you know, the Eastman Kodak days. And he ran across some that he had taken in 1973 and shot them to me. Anyway, so since this happened a couple of weeks ago, I thought, oh, I have a picture. Anyway, so the for what it's worth, I mean, it's not going to be of interest to most people.
But, oh, it's of great interest. Are you kidding? This is you in college? Are you a freshman? What year are you?
I was a freshman.
As all freshmen do, you had stolen a street sign. I think that's good.
I had my, yes, my required street sign and posters on the wall. Yeah. And I love the out of focus in the foreground coffee pot.
We know where that started.
I still remember that particular coffee pot. That was a very important item in my life at the time.
That's great. I love it.
And there is in the upper left, you can sort of bear, I know what it is because I remember it, but I was messing around with plotters and the Xerox graphics printer. And so there are some vestiges of things from Sale, Stanford's AI lab at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, just crazy stuff. So, and then there's that cranky woman whose picture is covering up the sign.
We've all seen that.
I don't remember whether I took it or Jim took it, but I was messing with black and white and Ilford film at the time.
So it's your picture, huh?
And so I might have, that was an actual woman in Berkeley who was really not happy to have her picture taken by some random kid. But she was just such a grouch. I put her on the, you know, I thought, well, I'll make an enlargement and have fun with that. So anyway.
You also have the requisite danger sign. Everybody should have that. I mean, this is good. This is good. I love this. This is so classic. I know this era. What was the 71, 72, thereabouts, somewhere like that?
Yeah, it was 1973 is when I graduated from high school. So it would have been toward the end of 73 that I was a freshman at Berkeley.
Wow.
Yep.
That's
anyway.
Thank you, Steve.
Just a little,
you made
little
my
blast
day.
From the past.
That's awesome.
And I haven't changed a bit,
a bit
since then.
You know what? You were actually a little chubbier then. You know, you leaned out a little bit.
Yeah, I had a little bit of meat on me back in those days.
But that mustache,
and
that's
like
the same
sideburns,
one.
Leo, they come right down and wrap around underneath my jawline there.
Love them. Very impressive. I had your hair, too. I had that exact hair. It's so funny.
Everybody did back
so
then.
Cute.
Now none of us do.
Right.
So starting last Wednesday, the 17th, our long dormant Windows 7 update suddenly sprang back to life as Microsoft began rolling out an important, is what it was labeled, update for their long since forgotten Win 7 64-bit systems. It's 4567409, titled, quote, Microsoft Edge update for Windows 7 for 60. I know. It's like, what? For x64-based systems. And, of course, that's their new Chromium-based Edge web browser. The bulletin states that this update is not being offered to enterprise devices, only to users running Windows 7 Service Pack 1 and Win 8.1 Home, Professional, Ultimate, Starter, or Core editions. And they wrote, this update is not intended to target enterprise devices. Specifically, this update targets devices that run Windows 7 SP1 or later versions and Windows 8.1 or later versions that are either Home, Professional, Ultimate, Starter, or Core. Devices that run these editions on Active Directory or Azure Active Directory domain are also excluded from this automatic update. So in other words, all like the rest of us. They said it's only available via Windows Update and not being offered as a standalone download from the Microsoft Update catalog, as opposed to, as we'll see in a minute here, some things that I wish were being offered by Windows Update but aren't. They said, after being installed, the following changes will be made. And this, again, this is unsolicited, right? Edge will be pinned to the taskbar and add a shortcut to the desktop. If the current version of Edge, if any, already has a shortcut, it will be replaced. The new Edge will not replace IE. And this update will not change the system's default URL handler. So that's nice. It's not like suddenly it pops up when you click a link if you've got Chrome or Firefox on Windows 7. But still, it's interesting. You know, it suggests that Microsoft would like to have a bit of a foothold in all of those non-enterprise machines that are still stubbornly running Windows 7. And I was curious, like, what that meant. The latest market share has Windows 10 solidly in, that is a market share of the desktop, Windows 10 solidly in first place at 53.74%. Windows 7 is in solid second place at 28.35. But after that, so 10, Windows 10 at nearly 54%, Windows 7 at about 28%. Then it's a drop to third place for Mac OS 10 version 10.14 at, get this, 3.84%, then Windows 8.1 at 3.65. So together, the pair of Windows 10 and Windows 7 total 82% of all desktops. So, you know, it's still going strong. And, you know, and I guess I can see why Microsoft might not be willing to concede the desktop browser to Chrome when it no doubt feels that it now finally has something, thanks to Chromium, of course, that's every bit as good. But anyway, it's just kind of weird that, you know, yo, we're not going to fix any security problems you have, but we think you should have the Edge browser just, you know, on Windows 7 just because. It's like,
wow.
Okay.
Of all things weird? To update, that's so weird.
I know.
You know, I had a call this weekend on the radio show by a guy who said that happened. And I was skeptical. I thought, why would Microsoft do that?
Doesn't that sound completely random? Sense. It's like, what?
Well, they were.
Yeah. And I did already, because, you know, of the podcast, I already had Edge on my Win 7 machine that I'm sitting in front of right now. And so I didn't notice any change. I did go into it to see, like, if it said anything about update pending or a new version or something, but I didn't catch anything. But anyway, I thought that was just sort of curious. And certainly there are, what is it, about one-third more, no, half as many Windows 7 now as Windows 10. So it's beginning to ebb, and you would expect that now that, you know, security updates have once and for all finally really truly been terminated. So yeah, it's pushed people over to Windows 10. And I'm sort of making a fragile peace with it. I tried to install Windows 10 over the weekend on an old 86 machine. The very end of the work that I was doing on this new initdisk utility, somebody managed to get it to pop up a complaint about the floppy drive not being ready on one of his systems. And I was unable to make it happen. And then he explained, oh, no, you have to have a diskette controller on the motherboard with no disk drive, no floppy drive plugged into the controller. If it's plugged into the controller, no problem. But if it's a floppy controller that doesn't have a floppy drive on it, then to make a long story short, I fixed that and no longer does that. But in order to verify it, I had to install Windows 7 on an old machine that still had a floppy controller. Turns out that they're kind of rare now. It's easy to plug in a USB floppy drive, and most BIOSes
those are
know
pretty
how to
rare
that.
Too. I'm amazed you could find one.
But then I wanted to try Windows 10 because I figured, well, while I'm at it, I might as well be able to boot this old x86 machine into 7 or 10. And it kept refusing to take a Windows 10 install. Finally, I cloned the x86 Windows 7 install to another drive. Then I used that installer updater thing, I can't remember the exact name for it, which runs on x86. It came up under Windows 7, said, hi, would you want to update to Windows 10? And I said, yes, because nothing else that works. So it downloaded what it needed to and churned away for a while and rebooted a few times and finally said, this Pentium 4 doesn't support NX. Windows 10 will not run. So thought, oh, that's interesting. So that's, of course, the no execute bit, which was added later to the Pentium 4 than my chip, apparently. And so no go. So anyway, I'm happy with Windows 7 on that. And I'll be talking about a NIT disk a little bit later. And I have no idea how I got off onto this.
Well, but just to be clear, you need to do this because of SpinRite. You got to have all this legacy stuff lying around,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, that's precisely why.
Right.
And the technology that I'll be talking about later is a spinoff of SpinRite because I needed an absolutely bulletproof. Well, I'll talk about it in a minute. Later. We got lots of other stuff to talk about. Google.
Yes.
Yanked 106 out of 111, apparently five somehow they didn't agree with, malicious Chrome extensions, which were found to be collecting sensitive user data. The well-named cybersecurity firm Awake Security, because that's the way you want your cybersecurity firms, identified the extensions as malicious in a report they published last Thursday, which they titled, "The Internet's New Arms Dealers, Malicious Domain Registrars." And of course, you and I, how many times have we talked about the danger of DNS registrars doing the wrong thing? You know, domain name registrars, you know, issuing certs that they shouldn't. In this case, they explained that their report dives into the results of their multi-month investigation that uncovered a massive global surveillance campaign affecting millions of users, like 33 million. The campaign involved thousands of domains and more than 100 malicious Chrome extensions, with all the activity tying back to a single internet domain registrar, GAL communication. And they have in here, they have Comuni, C-O-M-M-U-N-I, GAL Limited, also known as GALCOM. They said this campaign and the Chrome extensions included operations such as taking screenshots of the victim device, loading malware, reading the clipboard, and actively harvesting tokens and user input. In the wake of Awake's disclosure, Google has taken down the malicious extensions, all but five. However, the campaign was able to avoid detection by using state-of-the-art security tools through a number of evasion schemes. So this report highlights that they said the attacker's infrastructure, including 15,160 malicious or suspicious domains and 111 malicious or fake Chrome extensions that collectively had approximately 33 million downloads. They said that connections between the campaign and a number of traditional malware families had been seen. The methods the attacker used to avoid detection by sandboxes, endpoint detection and response systems, web proxies, and more, they also got into. And the way Awake connected the dots leading to back to a single domain registrar. They said that the extensions posed as tools to improve web searches, to convert files between different formats, to perform security scans, and more. But the extensions contained code to bypass Google's Chrome Web Store security scans, thus to get into the store in the first place, then once downloaded, as had happened 33 million times, to take screenshots, to snag the global clipboard, to harvest authentication cookies, snag user keystrokes, including passwords. They said that they believed all the extensions were created by the same entity through the although the company has not yet identified who that entity is. The primary connection between all the extensions was that they sent user data back to domains that were all registered through the Galcom domain registrar. And they said that many extensions appeared to share the same graphics and code base with only slight changes. That similarity made scanning for their sibling extensions much easier. Some of the extensions even shared version numbers and descriptions that no one had bothered to change from one to the other because they were just basically spitting these out, trying to sneak them past Google. And, you know, it had become a numbers game. So anyway, someone had gotten lazy about covering their tracks. You know, and I have two screenshots from the Chrome Web Store of two samples. One is calls itself Byte Fence Secure Web Browsing. You know, okay. And they all did have lots of faked user feedback, you know, 5-star browsing extensions, you know, the best antivirus software I have or I've ever had or something, you know, complete nonsense. Also, another one, secured search extension. It's like, you know, what? Who knows? But people were downloading it because, oh, look, I'd like to have my searches extended or secured. So Awake said that by last month, when it reached out to Google, having finished its research, the 111 malicious extensions they had identified had been downloaded, oh, not quite 32,962,951 times. And I you know, I suppose the rule here is if you build it, they will download it. And indeed, that happened. Based on their internal telemetry, Awake says that some of these extensions have been found on the networks of financial services, oil and gas, media and entertainment, healthcare and pharmaceutical companies, retailers, high tech, high education, and government organizations. They are currently, well, they were acting as backdoors into private networks and as espionage tools, though they have no direct evidence to suggest that they've ever been used that way. The capability is there in them. So, after being notified, Google has so far proactively deactivated 106 out of the 111 identified Chrome extensions, and they've been, you know, so they're obviously removed from the web store, but they've been actually turned off in every user's browser. The extensions are still installed, but they've been disabled and marked as malware. So if you were interested, you go to chrome:// extensions, which is the way your Chrome browser will show you what's installed. And if it's been turned off, it will be, there's a like a red malware that is saying, you know, we turned this off to protect you. Also, you should, if you see that, you should take a lesson from the fact that, you know, basically this is a numbers game and you don't want to get bitten by this. And it's probably a good moment for us to just mention that, you know, add-ons of all types have become the new front in the war on consumer trust. We know that Apple and Google invest heavily in the safety and security of third-party apps and add-ons that they curate in their various app stores, but that nevertheless, stuff is going to slip past. Many people choose an Android device because, as we know, they are typically less expensive and often because of the greater user freedom that comes with a more open platform. And perhaps like your daughter, Abby, Leo, they just don't like Apple for whatever reason. So they're gonna give their money to Samsung or Google or another hopefully major Android brand because we know how important it is that these things get updates. But the same openness which is given to the user is also available to the apps. and the user is trusting those to be safe. So, you know, the bottom line is with these deals where you've got add-on apps and extensions is that it is a pure numbers game. The chance that any one particular app might be malicious is probably small because, you know, these companies are doing a good job. But every additional app or add-on which is installed increases the probability that one of the growing collection is probably malicious. So it's prudent not to let the crap accumulate in your browser with extensions or in your smartphone with you know, add-on apps. It's useful to occasionally page through what you've downloaded and remove the things that you no longer use. Even though, Leo, I did hear you last podcast
indicate that stuff.
You've got things you haven't touched for years and you do not want them to be silently removed from your phone.
No. But you can turn that off, so I do.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, just, you know, download stuff with caution. I have a few things. I don't download add-ons in my browser because it is the case that, you know, every time you do something like that, you're taking a slight risk and that they do add up. Okay, Zoom's encryption story, take three. And I'm being kind, only Uh-oh. Saying three.
Yeah.
Last Wednesday, in an apparent effort to deal with his company's recent spate of confused mixed messages regarding Zoom's actual plans for enforcing truly secure end-to-end encrypted teleconferences, Eric Yuan attempted to clean things up in a blog. Eric wrote exactly the following. Since releasing the draft design of Zoom's end-to-end encryption on May 22nd, we've engaged with civil liberties organizations, our CISO council, child safety advocates, encryption experts, government representatives, our own users, and others to gather their feedback on this feature. We've also explored new technologies to enable us to offer end-to-end encryption to all tiers of users. Today, Zoom released an updated end-to-end encryption design on GitHub. And I looked and there, it was just like commas and dots and things were changed. No biggies. He said, we are also pleased to share that we have identified a path forward that balances the legitimate right of all users to privacy and the safety of users on our platform. This will enable us to offer end-to-end encryption as an advanced add-on feature for all users around the globe, free and paid, while maintaining the ability to prevent and fight abuse on our platform.
Yeah, there's your clause.
Uh-huh. To make this possible, free/basic users seeking access to end-to-end encryption will participate in a one-time process that will prompt the user for additional information, such as verifying a phone number via a text message. Many leading companies perform similar steps on account creation to reduce mass creation of abusive accounts. We're confident that by implementing risk-based authentication in combination with our current mix of tools, including our report a user function, we can continue to fight and prevent abuse. Then under additional information, he said, just four bullet points, we plan to begin early beta of the end-to-end encryption feature in July. All Zoom users will continue to use AES 256 GCM transport encryption as the default encryption, one of the strongest encryption standards in use today. And note, that's the way they're differentiating. They're saying transport encryption as opposed to end-to-end encryption.
Right.
Then they says E2EE will be an optional feature as it limits some meeting functionality, such as the ability to include traditional dial-up phone lines or voice over IP hardware conference room systems. Hosts will toggle E2E on and off on a per meeting basis. And actually, I believe they meant only on, because they have previously said it will absolutely not be turn offable once it's been turned on. Then finally, the fourth bullet point, account administrators can enable and disable end-to-end encryption at the account and group level. And he finishes, we are grateful to those who have provided their input on our E2E design, both technical and philosophical. We encourage everyone to continue to share their views throughout this complex ongoing process. So
it feels to me like, honestly, they're trying to distract everybody from the real issue, which is it really end-to-end encryption?
Yes.
And I'm still unclear on that. What is your opinion on that?
So my opinion is they have royally screwed the pooch, and no one is ever going to trust them again. So they're trying to say, Alex has sort of talked about this. I'd seen references to it. The idea being that if they can, their concern is that there's rampant abuse of encrypted teleconferences because of the abuse of anonymity, and that if they can trade enhanced security for some reduction in anonymity, that will put off the abusers who will not want to give a phone number, which is then tied to their conferencing.
That makes sense, but it doesn't address the end-to-end encryption part of it. It's just talking about authentication. I keep feeling like they're trying to say, pay no attention to that. Here's what we're going to do for authentication. When they talk about this turning on this better than transport encryption.
Yeah.
In the same time as they talk about that, don't they still say, but we'll be able to help law enforcement, or we'll be able to give, I mean, don't they imply?
Well, you notice there was none of that language in his blog posting. What we know happened is there was a huge backlash from the industry at large at the idea that encryption was not going to be available for the free tier.
Yeah.
And then there was all this back and forth double talk about it. And, my feeling is after their out of the gate stumbles, they had one chance at redemption, the very first, initial problems they jumped on, but as we know, through a bizarre lack of messaging coherence, they just confused everybody.
Well, and I think that's intentional, is what I think. Go ahead. What do you think?
Maybe. I think they lost any hope forever of convincing those who most have a need for easy-to-use, really encrypted, warrant-proof conferencing that Zoom is the place to get it.
Right.
It just, no one is going to trust them or believe them again. And as you said, even now,
it's not clear.
Some confusion.
Is it warrant proof or isn't it? That's, by the way, that's a good test. And they've implied that they will help, but only in the case of child sex abuse material. But that's not the issue. And I feel like there's a lot of hand waving. I don't even think the free versus paid is the issue if none of it is end to end. And that's the real issue.
Correct. And their original issue with paid is that paying means there's a money trail.
Right.
And that creates a tighter identity confirmation.
Yeah, but that's not the question I had. Maybe some people have.
I know. I completely agree. But Leo, what's interesting, because I thought about this, no one has any similar concern about Apple. Apple has played the encryption issue exactly right from day one. Everyone knows that Apple's products are as absolutely and truly secure as Apple is capable of making them. Any mistakes that they or others find are immediately fixed. And Apple's very public fights with law enforcement have only proven to enhance their well-deserved reputation.
Does FaceTime, end-to-end, they don't have any that's warrant-proof encryption in FaceTime, at least person-to-person, right? Apple doesn't have the keys to that.
Well, no. And I still argue that if you're not managing the keys, somebody else is.
That's my point. Exactly.
And if somebody else is, that gives them the opportunity, whether they take it or not.
Right.
So, nothing we've seen has shown how they could engineer themselves out of that position. You know, and we've seen things that like, well, iCloud isn't encrypted, and if the FBI hadn't shut down and restarted the phone, blah 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 blah.
Yeah, we know Apple retains the keys to iCloud. That's known.
Yeah.
It is the case, though, that an iPhone has a secure enclave, generates its own keys, and so a point-to-point call in FaceTime.
Yes.
Should be fully encrypted. There's no Apple in between. I don't know how group calling. This is the challenge Zoom faces and everybody else's is group calling, right? Because you have to route video, unencrypted video at the server,
right?
So
I've listened to you talk about this across Twit, and I agree with you that it's unclear, how much Zoom style teleconferencing really needs uber secure end to end encryption anyway.
Right.
As we know, their post-COVID usage explosion is almost entirely replacing meetings, such as yoga classes and traditional classrooms.
Right.
They were publicly accessible and never particularly secure in the first place.
But there are dissidents. There are psychotherapists and psychiatrists. There are medical doctors. You know, HIPAA has been suspended for the nonce, so it's not even a HIPAA issue. But there's some reasons people might want to have really private conversations on Zoom.
Yeah.
Not all of them nefarious. If you run a Jitsi server, you have transport encryption decrypted at the server. But if you run the server, you still retain the keys. So it is possible to do something like that if you run your own server. It's my guess, and I wish they'd be clear about this, that they do retain the keys to it. Right? Zoom does. We've seen nothing to say they don't.
Well, the document says that their technology does negotiate end to end, and that they have no visibility into the keys.
Okay.
So if that document is adopted, and that's sort of the question too, is that it's not open source.
Well,
it's just a design goal.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, all right. It's good.
Speaking of a design goal, Leo,
this show is designed to give you breaks. That's the design goal. So you may caffeinate. I wish you still had that coffee pot. I'd love to see you reach over and get that 1974 coffee pot.
Just drink directly from the pot.
Our show today is brought to you by Extra Hop. These guys are great, doing some really interesting stuff. Extra Hop started, it's kind of a cool story, as a performance monitor. And they still actually can do that. But it turns out as they were monitoring your performance at scale, I mean across every cloud and all the way down to the end user, it turns out they also were able to monitor threats, cybercrime. And that's why ExtraHop is such a useful tool for you. The new IT reality is remote access is on a massive scale right now. Rapid cloud, even multi-cloud adoption, a steady increase of Internet of Things devices, all on top of a rise in cybercrime. You can see, even if you listen to this show, it's ripe right now for exploitation. That's why it's more important than ever that organizations can see what's going on in their environment from the cloud to the data center to the customer. In order to protect and scale your business, and you get both, you need more than unified visibility. You need a context for detections. You need intelligent response workflows so teams can collaborate and act fast. You need ExtraHop. ExtraHop. It helps you detect threats and performance issues up to 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently. And they have the customer base to prove it. Keep your business secure and available with a SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response tool. Wizards of the Coast uses it. They secure and support their AWS cloud with ExtraHop. Chief Architect, Information Security Officer Dan McDaniel said, quote, there's no other company that aligns to support the DevOps model, the speed, and the lack of friction than ExtraHop. Ulta Beauty uses ExtraHop to secure their Google Cloud, as well as keeping networking and security teams closely aligned so engineers have more time to focus on innovation. Senior IT engineer John Kreese says, before ExtraHop, we had limited visibility into what was going on in the cloud. Now, we can quickly identify vulnerabilities and exploits and understand how our applications are performing in the cloud. You get both. Take control of your cloud security with ExtraHop. Now, this is a great site to go to. You can see a dashboard, the actual tool in live and action. There's a full product demo at extrahop.com/security now. It's fun to see. It's a really cool dashboard. But there's also additional information there about securing and supporting remote access, all the things we have to do now in this new world of ours. ExtraHop. Check it out. extrahop.com/security. Now, I'm going to bet you're looking for something and have been looking for something like this. I want you to check them out. extrahop.com/security now. Go for the eye candy, stay for the security. I made that up. That's not their slogan. I'll probably hear from them. Go ahead, Steve.
What?
Why candy? No, that dashboard's so cool. It's so cool. All right, go ahead.
So anyway, I just wanted to touch on this briefly. Last week, we covered some of the many problems people were experiencing after installing Windows 10 June updates. Of course, among them was the printer not turned on before starting Windows, and the more significant, printing no longer works at all after the updates. As we were podcasting, Microsoft was acknowledging some printing problems and issuing an out-of-cycle emergency update to fix one of several problems, but apparently and incredibly, neither of the problems we talked about. There is another one, which they did fix, a crash in the print spooler that also prevents printing. In the Windows Message Center, Microsoft says, quote, an out-of-band optional update is now available on Microsoft Update Catalog to address a known issue in which certain printers may be unable to print after installing updates released on June 9th, 2020. The announcement noted that the issue could cause the print spooler to, quote, generate an error or close unexpectedly. And, of course, it's never supposed to close, so any closure would be unexpected when attempting to print, and no output will come from the affected printer. And they also said, and you might also encounter issues with the apps you are attempting to print from, such as receiving an error, or the app might close unexpectedly. And the issue, quote, might also affect software-based printers, such as when printing to PDF. So pretty much everything. And, you know, as I was reading that, and this is an optional update available in the catalog, it's unclear to me what users who are not proactive like about managing Windows are expected to do, because Microsoft recommends users to install one of the three consecutively numbered updates, 4.5.6.7, 5.12, 5.13, or 5.14, which are flagged as optional cumulative updates for Windows 10, and that spans versions 1909, 03, 09, 1809, and 1803, but only if their devices are affected by that issue. And they noted that these optional Windows 10 updates are not available from Windows Update and will not install automatically. And then, since they broke printing across all versions of Windows, 2 days later, last Thursday, they dropped another collection of similar optional cumulative updates to address that same printing issue on the versions that that first drop hadn't covered. I'm not supposed to say 2004 because that's confusing. 2004, 1709, 1703, 1607, and 1507. So all the way back. And Windows 8.1, Windows Server 2012, and Server 2016. So they just really messed things up. But still nothing about the be sure to turn the printer on first problem. What seems to me is that these things being optional, where the affected user must go to get the fix for the breakage, is puzzling. Because it sure seems to me that if Microsoft is going to automatically break somebody's Windows 10 machine, they really should also automatically fix what they've broken, especially when they've given now users no choice about whether to accept and install the forcible breakage in the first place. I don't know. It's just a little confusing at the moment. I did see some reference to them going to be changing their insider program and maybe rearranging things. I hope that, you know, they're able to get a handle on these things that they've been messing up recently. And maybe these are optional until next month. They didn't say that if you just waited until July, which, you know, is approaching, then they'll get all these fixed in the next cumulative roll-up. I hope so, because otherwise less proactive users are just going to stay broken. I mentioned the VLC media player or video LAN. I've got it installed on my machines. It's a great multi-purpose media player. Version 3.0.11 fixes what they described as a severe remote code execution flaw. So worth doing. It's available now, 3.0.11, for the desktop versions, Windows, Mac, and Linux. And in addition to some random bug fixes and improvements, the main reason to update if you are a user of VLC is that it fixes a severe security vulnerability. And this, of course, follows in the theme of interpreters are hard to make perfect, and unfortunately, perfection is required. It's tracked as a CVE 2020-13428, a buffer overflow in VLC's H.26x packetizer. And they said if exploited, it would allow attackers to execute code under the same security level as the user. So the good news is that it's running as a client of the OS in the user's account. It has no reach down into the kernel. The bad news is you still don't really want to be running somebody else's deliberately malicious code in your computer. And according to their security bulletin, this vulnerability can be exploited by creating a specially crafted file, like a malicious video, which could be posted somewhere, and having the user open it in VLC. That would be the exploitation of a remote code execution, is that the VLC would be used to read a file that had been crafted to take over your machine when that happens. So the VideoLAN guy said that the vulnerability would most likely only crash the player. They warned that it could be used by an attacker to execute code under the security level of the user remotely. But as we know, crashes are where exploits are born. So the fact that it's a crash today doesn't mean that's all it will stay. I would recommend anybody using VLC, just launch it. I did that last night when I saw this. I've been running 3.0.8, and immediately upon starting it, I got the news that 3.0.11 was available, and did I want to install it? So it's very quick to do, and just a heads up that's probably worth doing. Also, a puzzling update from Ross Komnanzor, which is my American pronunciation of a probably very different sounding.
Just make it sound like Boris Badenov. You'll be okay.
Exactly.
Ross Komnanzor.
That's as we've spoken of them often and had fun with their name, the Bureau serving as Russia's media watchdog. Okay, here's what's weird. They said that Telegram has agreed to help Russian law enforcement fight against extremist and terrorist content shared on Telegram, on the Telegram platform. I have a link to a Russian gov.ru page that I just figured that my fonts all broke when I clicked it because no.
Cyrillic.
So it's, no help there. But I did find some coverage of this in various places. Apparently, the Russian government has lifted its what was largely an ineffective 2-year ban on Telegram's instant messaging service, which we know is encrypted. And boy, all you have to do is just have it show up in Russian and it's encrypted. In a message posted on its website, Roskomnadzor said it lifted the ban after Russian prosecutors reached an agreement with Telegram's founder, Pavel Durov. Russian officials said that Durov, quote, expressed readiness to counter terrorism and extremism, unquote. Okay, now that doesn't actually say that Pavel agreed to, you know, drop his drawers for Russia. So we don't really know what has happened. The details about this collaboration, such as it might be between Telegram and Russian officials, has not been made public anywhere that I could find. Now, to remind our users, Russia officially banned Telegram a little over 2 years ago on April 13th of 2018. That ban followed Telegram's refusal to cooperate with Russia's FSB, their Federal Security Bureau, which is their primary intelligence service. At the time, FSB investigators tried to obtain the encryption keys from Telegram to decrypt conversations between two suspects that were under investigation in the 2017 St. Petersburg metro bombing. I'm sure that Pavel said, "We don't have the keys. Our system is designed end-to-end secure. Sorry, we can't help you." That wasn't the answer they were looking for. So being viewed as refusing to cooperate, the FSB filed a lawsuit, which, surprise, it eventually won in the Russian Supreme Court early in 2018. Russian officials initially fined Telegram, but then the Russian courts also ordered Roskomnadzor to ban the app inside Russia. Basically, you know, we're going to shut you down, you bad Telegram people. However, Roskomnadzor had a difficult time enforcing the ban over the past 2 years. Telegram constantly changed its server's IP addresses and also employed a technique known as domain fronting to bypass the ban. Domain fronting is basically, you know, using different domains as a front for the actual Telegram service, and that allowed Russian users to continue using its service. And recall that in one famous, or maybe now infamous, botched effort to ban the service in Russia, Roskomnadzor applied a wide area blanket block which affected more than 19 million Amazon and Google Cloud IP addresses, blocking out countless legitimate services inside Russia, such as all of Google's services, online games, banking sites, cryptocurrency exchanges, and mobile apps. They also, in a continuing effort, banned 50 VPN and proxy services that Russians were using to access Telegram. Throughout all of this, Telegram remained extremely popular in Russia, and despite the ban, was often used by Russian politicians themselves, because after all, secure, right? Encrypted, right? So the officials were trusting Telegram to keep their conversations safe from FSB surveillance. So, again, sort of a political win for Telegram for saying no to law enforcement, just as Apple has benefited from their own stance. So a few days prior to Ross Komnenzor lifting the ban, as they did last week, the Russian news site Zinak reported that Russian members of parliament had introduced a new bill to have the app unbanned, though it's unclear whether the bill played any role in Ross Komnenzor's lifting of the ban. However, I did some more digging, and I discovered that in April of 2020, the government of Russia started using Telegram themselves to spread information related to the COVID-19 outbreak.
Well, that's what people use.
Yes.
Yeah.
So perhaps that factored into this change. Yeah. They thought, well, okay, we don't like it, but it's secure. People are using it. We have not been able to block it. Now this is getting kind of embarrassing. So let's lift the ban and make it officially legal again. I also found that Ross Komnenzor had not indicated how the two organizations had been able to overcome the issue of Telegram's end-to-end encryption, if indeed they actually had. And I think they hadn't. It did not say whether it now had access to messages or whether changes had been made to the platform. And neither Telegram nor Pavel Durov, who both regularly use Telegram to communicate with their own users, have yet commented publicly on the lifting of the ban. So, you know, my own reading between the lines is that the Russian government, as I said, secretly regretted their opposition to Telegram, especially considering that it's the instant messaging platform of choice for many of them themselves. And perhaps the need to communicate through COVID-19 demonstrated the platform's versatility and utility. And they thought, well, since we can't actually stop it anyway, let's just, legitimize it. So, cool. Okay. This is one of the two biggies of the week. Netgear. There have previously been various other reports of random routers, even bunches of routers, having exploitable problems. But those reports haven't risen to the level required to raise an alarm for me to share with our listeners, because their problems have invariably been LAN-side issues rather than WAN-side problems. And while LAN-side issues are not nothing, they do not directly expose the router to external attack. They are only vulnerable to if an attacker has already gotten themselves inside, behind the router, on the LAN, and onto the network. And of course, once any attacker has accomplished that, it's pretty much the case that all bets are off. However, when a router is weak enough on the inside, there is one troubling case where an equally weak attacker, meaning attacker that doesn't have much attack strength, might be strong enough. And that's when a user browses to a malicious website. When that happens, the attacker's code is running in the visitor's browser, which exists on the LAN. We were recently talking about how JavaScript code was able to launch its own HTTP queries using the so-called AJAX primitives. AJAX is the abbreviation for asynchronous JavaScript and XML, which, again, it allows a web page to be active, to alter its contents, to establish a communication back to the originating web server, and so forth. So there are 79 Netgear models 79, so vulnerable, and we'll see in detail why in a moment, that just surfing to a malicious website could allow the code the browser downloads to blindly connect to the network's local Netgear router and cause it to open a telnet session with port and command prompt as root. Okay, so let's step back a bit. I should note that I created a link for our listeners. And Leo, you may be interested to bring it up. It's grc.sc/netgear. Just so anybody with a Netgear device, you're going to want to be seeing whether one of your 79 Netgear router models may be vulnerable and may have firmware available. grc.sc/netgear. SC, of course, for shortcut. So, okay, so here's what's going on. An unpatched zero-day vulnerability exists in 79 Netgear router models. It allows an attacker to take full control over any of those 79 Netgear model devices from within the LAN, even from code running inside a user's web browser. The vulnerability was independently discovered by two researchers. Naturally, it exists in the HTTPD, the HTTPD daemon used to manage the router. In other words, that's the router's web-based router management server, you know, web server, which you typically connect to with your browser. Unfortunately, your browser can connect to it when driven by script in the same way. One of the two researchers released a detailed explanation of the vulnerability, a proof of concept exploit, and scripts to find vulnerable routers. So the hackers of the world are already clued in. All of this is public. The proof of concept and the script are up on GitHub, and their detailed explanation is here in the show notes. So it is a fully detailed technical blog, and the posting is quite detailed. So I'm going to excerpt from the full posting enough to touch on the most interesting and important highlights. It's well written, and this is a perfect look into the process of exploitation and just a classic mistake. So this guy started with the Netgear R7000. He says, after a long day of hard research, it's fun to relax, kick back, and do something easy. While modern software development processes have vastly improved the quality of commercial software as compared to 10 to 15 years ago, consumer network devices have largely been left behind. Thus, when it's time for some quick fun and a nice confidence boost, I like to analyze small office, home office, he has in parentheses, SOHO devices. This blog describes one such session of auditing the Netgear R7000 router, analyzing the resulting vulnerability and the exploit development process that followed. The write-up and code for the vulnerability described in this blog post can be found in our Not Quite Zero Day Friday repository. He says, the first step when analyzing a SOHO device is to obtain the firmware. Thankfully, Netgear's support website hosts all the firmware for the R7000. The Netgear R7000 version 1.0.9.88 firmware used in this blog post can be downloaded from the website. After it unzipping the firmware, we'll use Binwalk to extract the root file system from the firmware image. While the router may have many services worth analyzing, the web server is often the most likely to contain vulnerabilities. And I'll add that it's also always listening with a port open to the LAN. So an obvious target of opportunity if you could do anything useful on the land side. So they continue. In SOHO devices like the R7000, the web server must parse user input from the network and run complex CGI functions that use that input. Furthermore, the web server is written in C and has had very little testing, and thus it is often vulnerable to trivial memory corruption bugs. As such, he writes, I decided to start by analyzing the web server HTTPD. As we're interested in how the web server mishandles user input, the logical place to begin analyzing the web server is the receive function. The receive, abbreviated RECV, is used to retrieve the user input from a connection. Thus, by looking at the references to the receive function in the web server, we can see where the user input begins. The web server has two helper functions which call receive, one used in the HTTP parser and one used to read the responses from dynamic DNS requests to oemdns.com. He says, we'll focus on the former use as shown below in the hexrays decompiler. And he has a snippet of decompiled code. Of course, hexrays, remember, is the IDA, the interactive disassembler, which is the industry's longest running and very popular way of decompiling something, which is only available in binary. Okay, so I'm going to go through this, but this won't take long, unfortunately. He says, after the call to read content, the receive helper function, the parser does some error checking, combines the received content with any previously received content, and then looks for the strings named M10FW upload, okay, as in firmware upload, and \R\N\R\N, which of course is character turn line feed, character turn line feed, meaning the, and that's, you know, two CRLFs is typically the way you end ASCII-based input. He says in the user input. If the user input contains these strings, that is that M10FW upload and the two CRLFs, the rest of the user input after these strings is passed to the AB checkboard ID function. Grepping the firmware's root file system, we can see that the string M10FW upload is referenced from the files /upg_upgrade.htm. In other words, you know, firmware upgrade and also modem upgrade htm, he says. And thus, we can conclude that this is part of the router's upgrade functionality. Then in his blog posting, he breaks to post 1996 calling. They want their vulnerability back. He says, following the user input, we next look at the AB checkboard ID function. This function, shown below, expects the user input to be the firmware file for the R7000. It parses the user input to validate the magic value, bytes 0 through 3, obtains the header size, bytes 4 through 7, and checksum, bytes 36 through 49, and then copies the header to a stack buffer. This copy, performed via the memcopy function, uses the size specified in the user input. All right, everybody, I'll say that again. The copy performed via memcopy uses the size specified in the user input. In other words,
well, the user
it
knows
is trivial
of course.
To overflow the stack buffer. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
He says, in most modern software, this vulnerability would be unexploitable First of all, having that vulnerability is unconscionable. The idea that you're going to take the input from the input is nuts, but that's what this does. He says, modern software typically contains stack cookies, which would prevent exploitation. However, the R7000 does not use stack cookies. In fact, of all the Netgear products which share a common code base, thus the reason that 79 of them are all, they all fall to this exploit, only, he writes, the D8500 firmware version 1.0.39.29 and the R6300 V2 firmware versions 1.0.4.12 through .20 use stack cookies. However, later versions of the D8500 and R6300 V2 stopped using stack cookies, making this vulnerability once again exploitable against all of them as well. He says this is just one more example of how SOHO device security has fallen behind compared to other modern software. And he says, in addition to lacking stack cookies, the web server is also not compiled as a position-independent executable and thus cannot take advantage of ASLR, you know, address space layout randomization. As such, it's trivial to find what he says, he writes, a ROP, R-O-P gadget. Of course, that's return-oriented programming gadget, meaning the tail end of some existing routine that has a snippet of code that he wants to repurpose. He said, within the HTTPD binary, such as the one shown below, that will call the system with a command taken from the overflown stack. And so it's just two instructions, move RO, SP, meaning from the register zero and the stack pointer, and then a branch if less, BL, to system, meaning it is trivial to generate your, to put your own command on the stack and have the system execute it. He says the exploit in Grimm's not quite zero-day Friday repository uses this gadget, this return-oriented programming gadget, to start the telnet daemon as root, listening on TCP port 8888 and not requiring a password to log in. And as the vulnerability occurs before the cross-site request forgery CSRF token is checked, this exploit can be served via a CSRF attack. If a user with a vulnerable router, that is any of those 79, browses to a malicious website, that website could exploit the user's router via the browser. He said the developed exploit, and it's all there, demonstrates this ability by serving an HTML page which sends an AJAX request containing the exploit to the target device. However, as the CSRF webpage cannot read any responses from the target server, it's not possible to remotely fingerprint the device. You know, you could do other things to do that, like from the webpage, establish a communication with the web browser, get the version number, and so forth. Anyway, he says, so the attacker must know the model and version that they're exploiting. These guys didn't want to, you know, build a full-blown, seriously deadly proof of concept because it would be immediately weaponized by bad guys. They said many SOHO devices share a common software base, especially among devices created by the same manufacturer. As such, a vulnerability in one device can normally be found in similar devices by the same manufacturer. In this case, he writes, was able to identify 79 different Netgear devices and 758 firmware images that included a vulnerable copy of the web server. This vulnerability affects firmware as early as 2007. That was the WGT-624v4 version 2.0.6. Given the large number of firmware images, manually finding the appropriate gadgets is infeasible. Rather, this is a good opportunity to automate gadget detection. And he goes on to do that. But anyway, everybody gets the idea. He notes at the end of his post that on June 15th, so what, Monday before last, Vietnam's ZDI group, the Zero Day Initiative, published an advisory by darkness from VNPTISC, that's the Vietnam ZDI, on this vulnerability. That's the other guy, that's the other group that independently discovered this. Adam's Grimm Group, discovered the issue independently and reported the vulnerability directly to Netgear on May 7th of this year. So what, a little over like a month and a half ago. So obviously, anyone owning and using a Netgear router of any model should start checking in with Netgear for news of new firmware for their particular router. Through this, I've been assuming that no one would be crazy enough to have enabled web-based remote administration on their router's WAN interface. It is an option. It is, thank goodness, disabled by default, so somebody would have to turn it on purpose. You know, if by any chance you have done that for some reason, immediately turn it off or update your firmware. But really, having a web browser on the WAN interface, as this exact problem demonstrates, is crazy. This is a zero authentication attack on an extremely insecure web server. You do not want that facing the public internet. At the time of this podcast, Netgear had only addressed the problem for 8 of their 79 vulnerable router models. Their advisory was first published last Thursday, the 18th, and they have since updated it 3 times as they prepare and release additional firmware updates. I'm quite certain this is a nightmare for them, and they're doing everything as quickly as possible to get the firmware fixed and released. I found this page, that grc.sc/netgear, which of course is my shortcut that redirects to their much longer URL. It was the top item on their support advisories. So you can also just go to Netgear support and look at security advisories, and it's right there. Security advisory for multiple vulnerabilities on some routers, mobile routers, modems, gateways, and extenders. So, it's across their product line. They just use the same bad web server everywhere. I have a Netgear cable modem that I love and an ASUS Wi-Fi router. But the Netgear cable modem is outboard of my pfSense firewall router, and the ASUS is inboard, serving not as a router, only as a Wi-Fi access point. So for me, having that professional-grade pfSense firewall provides a great deal of peace of mind. I can't recommend it highly enough. You can install it on any little network-enabled gizmo, a Raspberry Pi, a little Intel, fanless box, anything, or just buy one of their little appliances for a couple hundred dollars. It's great technology. Meanwhile, DDoS is alive and well and growing. We haven't touched on DDoS attacks much recently because there hasn't been much news. But breaking a record is always newsworthy. And the record for the largest sustained DDoS attack was recently broken. The second highest previous record was set at a whopping 1.3 terabits per second. That's 1.3 trillion bits per second. 1.3 thousand billion bits per second, which hit GitHub back in February of 2018. That was topped a month later by the second current, what had been the record holder since, at 1.7 terabits per second, which was aimed at NetScout in March of 2018. Both NetScout and GitHub, both of those attacks abused internet-exposed memcached servers to achieve their massive bandwidths. But now, although they didn't advertise it at the time, in an incident quietly disclosed in its AWS Shield Threat Landscape report, Amazon's AWS service disclosed that they had successfully mitigated the largest ever DDoS recorded, weighing in at 2.3 terabits per second. 2.3 billion bits per second. They did not disclose the intended target, but they did indicate that the attack was carried out using hijacked CLDAP servers, resulting in 3 days of elevated threat for its AWS Shield staff. CLDAP, which is Connectionless Lightweight Directory Access Protocol, which is an alternative to the older LDAP protocol, which is used to search, connect, and modify internet shared directories. It's been abused for DDoS attacks since late 2016. And CLDAP servers are known to be able to amplify DDoS traffic by 56 to 70 times its initial size, making it a highly sought after protocol. And also a common option provided and used by DDoS for hire services. Attacks this large, 2.3 terabits, are fortunately still quite rare. And they surprise those running attack mitigation services. There are far more much smaller attacks happening pretty much continuously. Cloudflare, who mitigated a 550 gig per second attack during the first quarter of 2020, noted that 92% of all the DDoS attacks they mitigate, that is Cloudflare, or mitigated during the same first quarter of 2020, were under 10 gig of gigabits per second, 92. So in other words, only 8% topped 10 gigabits per second. And they also noted that 47% of all the attacks were even smaller, under 500 megabits per second. So, it's very much the a curve with a long tail and then a sharp, exponentiation at the very end. Very few super high bandwidth attacks, lots of much lower bandwidth attacks. And as we know, DOS and DDoS are one of the consequences of the internet's autonomous packet routing system, which has served us so well from the start. As long as it's possible to query a remotely located public server with a UDP packet that does not require TCP's round trip, and if the query's source IP can be spoofed without being blocked on its way out onto the public internet, and if the remote server's reply to the query is much larger than the query itself, amplified DDoS spoofing attacks are going to be a feature of our global Internet of Networks until we eliminate some of those conditions for that kind of attack. And Leo, last break, then we've got errata, and it's a little bit of SpinRite news, and then we're going to talk about ripples in the space-time continuum.
Okay. Deal. Ripples in the space-time. Wow, this is getting heavy. Our show today brought to you by Hot Stuff Wasabi. Hot cloud storage is the perfect solution if you're looking for cloud storage that is less expensive than on-prem storage, more secure than on-prem storage, and like faster than Amazon S3? This is Wasabi. Wasabi is an amazing service. 80% less expensive than Amazon's S3. Up to 6 times faster. And in fact, it's so affordable, it's actually less than the maintenance fees for a same amount of on-prem storage. Now, I know some of you say, well, but I need on-prem storage. The problem is data is growing at a rapid rate. I mean, you want to buy more hard drives every week, not to mention the service contracts, the support, and the lack of security. Wasabi's actually better. It's actually better. 11 nines of durability. That means on average you'd lose one file every 649,000 years. They do active integrity checking. Every file checked every 90 days, every 3 months. They're HIPAA compliant, FINRA compliant, CJIS compliant. They're hosted in redundant premier tier 4 data center facilities. Highly secure. In fact, encryption's on by default. Even if you don't request it, encryption is on at rest. They follow industry best practices for security and design. They have access control mechanisms, things like bucket policies and access control lists. My favorite part is your data can be designated immutable. That is, unalterable. It cannot be changed willfully by a user, maliciously by a bad guy. No ransomware, nothing. I think Wasabi is pretty amazing. Now, even just the base pay-as-you-go price is better than anybody else out there. And incidentally, they don't charge for egress either. That's one thing with S3. You say, oh, this is cheap. And then when you want your data back, oh, you're going to charge me for that, eh? Oh, not Wasabi. It starts less expensive, and there is never a charge for egress or API access, and it uses the same API as S3. So you already have tons of tools to work with it. You know how to use it. None of these complex, crazy storage tiers. It's just, boom. You know, this is the price. I think it's $5.99 per terabyte per month. That's it, $5.99 per terabyte per month. Compare that to physical storage. You'll see. That's a great deal. But it gets even better because they now have something called Wasabi's reserved capacity storage. That means you buy cloud storage. You know, probably, in many cases, you know how much data you're generating, how much new on-prem storage you're going to need every month, every year. So just buy ahead. If you're thinking about buying more hardware storage, compare instead the price against 5 years of reserved capacity storage. You'll see the difference. You can reserve cloud storage in 1, 3, or 5 year increments. You'll get bigger discounts the more you reserve, the longer you reserve. So this is you don't have to do it this way, but if you kind of have a, you know, and I think in many cases you don't know, this is how much data we're going to be using every day, every month, every year. So we know we're going to be buying that much hard drive. Get Wasabi instead. And if you're a managed service provider, you're going to love Wasabi because you could charge your clients less and still make more money. It's that big a price difference. The only problem with Wasabi, it ain't Amazon, Google, or Microsoft. And the boss is going to say, who are these Wasabi guys? I never heard of them. But tell the boss. Say, look, it's less expensive. It's faster. It's more durable. It's going to save us money. Calculate the savings for yourself. Start a free trial of storage. You get a month free at wasabi.com. Click the free trial link. And if you would, please enter the offer code SecurityNow. That way they'll know you heard it here. Security Now. We want to get credit for it. And then you can tell me later, thank you. I get thank you notes all the time. And by the way, it is enterprise-grade cloud storage. It's designed for big businesses. I know people who use it as their cloud backup. There's all sorts of ways you could use Wasabi. At that price, why not? Join the movement. Migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Wasabi.com. Free trial link. Click that and enter the offer code Security Now. Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. You may not have heard of them before, but you will. You will. They're setting the industry on its ear. Wasabi.com. Offer code security now. And now, back to Steve.
So, a piece of errata. We don't often have much. I title this, My How Time Flies. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, Leo, our off-the-cuff and inaccurate discussion of how long we've been at this podcast generated some conversation over in GRC's Security Now news group, the upshot of which was someone named Rob Allen summarizing our current position quite succinctly. Rob wrote, "We are currently in the 15th season or year 15 of the show,
yes.
Though it has only been 14 years and 10 months since August 18th, 2005. On August 17th, the show will have been on the air for 15 full years, making August 11th the final episode of year slash season 15. Season slash year 16 will start August 18th, 2020, with episode 780. So we're at 772, so 8 episodes from now, we will be beginning year 16 of this podcast. So there we have it. We've been almost 15 years. And the gang over in the news group mentioned Time and Date, A-N-D, timeanddate.com, which is a pretty slick site for performing various sorts of time and date math. I did a quick computation about when our final podcast would occur.
Oh.
Since we're at I thought that would be interesting. Since we're at 772 and we run out of digits, of course, at 999, that's 227 remaining podcasts. So at one podcast per week, that's 1589 days, which is 4.35 years. But since we'll have some holiday best of, that'll extend that number by another 4 weeks, since we'll cross 4 holiday events. So it's really around 1617 days from now. I dropped that number into timeanddate.com, launching from today, what is 1617 days from now, and that places our final 999th podcast at Tuesday, November 26th, 2024.
Perfect.
Which really isn't that far away, you know.
No, shut
2024,
up.
2024. We're going to be there in no time.
Damn it. No. Can we go just to the end of the year? How about that? We'll do a holiday episode. Give me a couple extra. No. All right.
I don't know how we'll number them, Leo.
We don't have to give them a number.
A, B.
A, B, and C. We'll just, it'll be 999, A, B, and C. That's it.
Actually, we could do -3, -2, -1, and 0.
We've never done the 0. You can't really do a podcast that doesn't start at 0.
Oh, we could do 0, 0, 0, and 0, 0, 0, because I do have 3 digits.
You see?
So that could work. Yeah,
that's pretty
good.
It'll also
that
be
that does sort of fudge the ending. It makes it a soft
20 years of Twit. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's up to you. I don't. You know, Twit's going to reach its 1,000th right about then as well. So that will be that will be intriguing to see what happens after we go to.
So I do have a piece of freeware to announce, which I think our listeners may find useful. It's Windows, even though it's got some DOS connection. It's called InitDisk, InitDisk. You could Google GRC space InitDisk. It already turns up. Or it is under GRC's main menu under freeware utilities. Or you can just go to grc.com/InitDisk. The backstory is that to aid the forthcoming testing of Spinrite's new technologies, we needed a simple way to prepare a bootable USB drive. And because I always start from scratch at the beginning from bare metal and then build up from there, we wound up with a uniquely capable new utility. During our testing, a number of those who were testing found that USB thumb drives they had long believed to have died and to be dead were immediately brought back to life by a knit disk. Again, it's, you know, I wrote it, it's all an assembler, it's from scratch. I wanted to, you know, basically take complete ownership of create a really robust formatting utility for removable USB. And just this morning, I encountered another report by a frequent contributor who goes by Obi-Wan in the news groups. He wrote, and he had not been participating all along, so he wasn't aware of a knit disk's ability to bring dead USB drives back. He said, tried it on a rather old TDK TF10 parens 8 gig USB stick, which was dead, he has in quotes. That is, Windows was unable to recognize it. At best, it was recognized, but a very small capacity. He said, found it inside a closet. Not sure how long it was there. At any rate, downloaded, meaning a NIT disk, and started a NIT disk. Upon startup, it asked me to insert the device, which is the way a NIT disk operates, the way it identifies what you want to reformat. He says, asked me to insert the device, did so by inserting the, and again in quotes, dead key. A NIT disk recognized it, he said, so I went on with the nuke. That's what you actually have to do. Once a NIT disk recognizes it, it shows you everything it knows about it to help you identify it. And then you have to type N-U-K-E in order to give it permission. And he says, went on with nuke and at end had the 8 gigabyte stick alive again. He says, not bad, I think. Further checks performed using various tools reported it to be okay. So, well, at least that init disk tool may be useful to recover, to some extent, not pretending miracles, some USB sticks. So, anyway, as I said, I don't think Obi-Wan had been following along, so he wasn't aware that we had seen a number of these instances. So, the industry has a bit of new freeware from GRC. As I mentioned, it's the first of what I expect will be a couple offshoots from Spinrite's work. The next thing will be a very cool bare metal bootable mass storage device benchmarking tool. That's what I'm immediately going to start working on, given the fact that GRC's DNS benchmark remains our number one most downloaded utility. It's now at nearly 5.8 million downloads, and it's being downloaded at a rate of 3,000 per day. My hope is that this forthcoming mass storage benchmark will also develop a following. And there's a method to my madness here. Everyone who uses it will also be simultaneously testing and verifying the new hardware driver suite that will be then moved into Spinrite. So the more early testing we can get of that new code, the better. And also, anyone wishing to verify that the next and all future Spinrites will work for them on whatever hardware they have will be able to use this free benchmark utility, which utilizes all of the same technology, to verify that for themselves, to make sure. And of course, if not, I want to know about it so I can fix it now. So I'll also be launching shortly a new set of GRC forums to make reporting and managing of any problems much easier for the users of the benchmark. So lots of happy activity going on over here and some cool new code being produced. You can optionally have a NIT disk create a bootable FreeDOS disk for you. You just add the command FreeDOS after init disk. It's not the default because most people are not going to want that. They're just going to want a nice, you know, a nice reformatted USB stick or drive. You can even use one like I used a USB to SATA interface, and it, you know, beautifully formatted. It'll run on any drive up to 2.2 terabytes, which is the limit for the 32-bit sector count, which the MBR, the master boot record, uses. This is not yet GPT. We will be at some point adding that, but not at this point yet. This is just to make it easy to boot things for people who want to play with my forthcoming work in FreeDOS. Okay. Ripples in the space-time continuum. The rhetorical question is, just how much damage can a little two-person company situated in Cincinnati, Ohio, do to the world? The answer to that question was likely revised this week. The company is Trek, T-R-E-C-K, Inc. They've got a very up-to-date looking website at https://trek.com. The site's homepage declares, since 1997, so 23 years, Trek has been designing, distributing, and supporting real-time embedded internet protocols for worldwide technology leaders. What could possibly go wrong? No, it doesn't say that. They said the Trek TCP/IP stack designer and Trek co-founder has more than 20 years experience and is a leading expert in embedded internet protocols. Well, as we know, anyone can be forgiven for making a mistake. And arguably, someone should probably have given a good hard look at these offerings before allowing 23 years of embedded device adoption to have occurred. But now is when we are. And as the Hacker News summed it up in their headline, new Ripple 20 flaws put billions with a B of internet-connected devices at risk of hacking. The Hacker News wrote at the top of their coverage, dubbed Ripple 20, the set of 19 vulnerabilities resides in a low-level TCP/IP software library developed by Trek, which, if weaponized, could let remote attackers gain complete control over targeted devices without requiring any user interaction. According to Israeli cybersecurity company JSOF, which I'll just be saying as JSOF, who discovered these flaws, the affected devices are in use across various industries ranging from home consumer devices to medical, healthcare, data centers, enterprises, telecom, oil, gas, nuclear, transportation, and many others across critical infrastructure. So switching to JSOF's summary and to get some additional details, they said the JSOF Research Lab has discovered a series of zero-day vulnerabilities in a widely used low-level TCP/IP software library developed by Trek, Inc. The 19 vulnerabilities, given the name Ripple 20, affect hundreds of millions of devices or more and include multiple remote code execution vulnerabilities. The risks inherent in this situation are high. Just a few examples, they say. Data could be stolen from a printer. An infusion pump's behavior could be changed. Or industrial control devices could be made to malfunction. An attacker could hide malicious code within embedded devices for years. One of the vulnerabilities could enable entry from outside into the network boundaries, and this is only, they said, a small taste of potential risks. The interesting thing about Ripple 20, they wrote, is the incredible extent of its impact, magnified by the supply chain factor. The widespread dissemination of the software library and its internal vulnerabilities was a natural consequence of the supply chain's ripple effect. A single vulnerable component, though it may be relatively small in and of itself, can ripple outward to impact a wide range of industries, applications, companies, and people. Ripple 20 reached critical IoT devices from a wide range of fields involving a diverse group of vendors. Affected vendors range from one-person boutique shops to Fortune 500 multinational corporations, including Cisco, HP, EMC, GE, Broadcom, NVIDIA, Schneider Electric, Intel, Rockwell Automation, Caterpillar, Baxter, as well as many other major international vendors suspected of being vulnerable in medical, transportation, industrial control, enterprise, energy, oil and gas, telecom, retail, and commerce, and other industries. They said Ripple 20 is a set of vulnerabilities found on the Trek TCP/IP stack. Four of the Ripple 20 vulnerabilities are rated critical, with CVSS scores over 9 and enabling remote code execution. One of the critical vulnerabilities is in the DNS protocol and may potentially be exploitable by a sophisticated hacker over the internet from outside the network boundaries, even on devices that are not connected to the internet. A second white paper to be released, because I looked at their first white paper, to be released following Black Hat USA 2020. So this is a pre-Black Hat presentation announcement, will be detailing the exploitation of CVE 2020-11901, a DNS vulnerability on a Schneider Electric ACP UPS device. They turn it off remotely with no authentication required. The other 15 vulnerabilities are in ranging degrees of severity, with CVSS scores ranging from 3.1 up to 8.2, and effects ranging from denial of service of the device to potential remote code execution. Most of the vulnerabilities are true 0 days, with 4 of them having been closed over the years as part of routine code changes, but remained open in some of the affected devices. 3 were lower severity, 1 was higher. Many of the vulnerabilities have several variants due to the stack configurability, that is the TCP/IP stack configurability, which things were included and which were not, and code changes over the years. Ripple 20 are the only vulnerabilities reported in as far as we know. In other words, nobody ever looked before. Except for some general logical vulnerabilities referenced in the past, which pertain to many stack implementations and usually had to do with RFC misinterpretations or deprecated RFCs. So just, standards spec things. They said Ripple 20 vulnerabilities are unique, both in their widespread effect and impact due to supply chain effect and being vulnerabilities allowing attackers to bypass NAT and firewalls and take control of devices undetected with no user interaction required. This is due to the vulnerabilities being in a low-level TCP/IP stack, meaning also in the kernel, and the fact that for many of the vulnerabilities, the packets sent are very similar to valid packets, or in some cases are completely valid. And in fact, I looked at the first white paper where they fragment a DNS packet and it's completely valid, but it causes a buffer overflow that allows you to inject your own code into any of these devices. This enables, they wrote, the attack to pass as legitimate traffic, because it is. So to give some sense for what has just happened, I have the top 6 vulnerabilities with the highest severities rated from 10 down to 9. And of course, 9 is still house on fire. So the number one most severe vulnerability, the one I referenced, has this is a CVE 2020-11896. And this is from the formal CVE severity scoring. This is not these guys pumping this up. This has a severity score of 10.0, right, on a scale of 1 to 10. Improper handling of length parameter inconsistency in IPv4 UDP component, that's DNS, when handling a packet sent by an unauthorized network attacker. This vulnerability may result in remote code execution. And I'll just tell everybody that you fragment a UDP DNS packet, and you get to run code on these devices. Also, 10.0, improper handling of length parameter inconsistency in IPv6 component when handling a packet sent by an unauthorized network attacker. This vulnerability may result in possible out-of-bounds write. So you get to write over areas that you're not supposed to. Again, executing code. 9.8, improper handling of length parameter and so forth. Anyway, there's 19 of these, and anytime you see improper handling of length parameter, it's very much like the problem we just talked about in the web server in the 79 Netgear firmware instances, where you're able to provide the length. It is the case that reassembly of fragmented packets is fraught with problems. I don't know why. But it is in the old days, that was a constant source of errors. And these guys at Trek made the errors. And unfortunately, their code has been widely adopted. It's written in C. They advertise that it runs on everything, any microprocessor, any embedded platform, with or without an underlying operating system, on an RTOS or not. You know, I mean, it's like everybody's answer. And it's probably affordable, so it got widely adopted. And now billions of devices have it, and as will be detailed at Black Hat, further detailed, are, you know, insecure. JSOF attempted to be as responsible as possible. They said that their disclosure had been postponed twice as pleas for more time came from some of the many vendors that they were able to determine were affected. And of course, they have limited surveillance abilities, with some of the vendors voicing COVID-19 related delays for the reason they weren't able to act more quickly. So out of consideration for those companies, the time period was extended from 90 to over 120 days. And even so, some of the participating companies became, they wrote, difficult to deal with as they made extra demands. And some, from their perspective, seemed much more concerned with their brand's image than with patching the vulnerabilities. In other words, they wanted to be, you know, not mentioned as being, you know, like they were a company or their stuff was vulnerable. So we know today that hundreds of millions, in the best case, of affected devices scattered all across the globe will almost certainly never receive security patch updates to address these critical Ripple 20 vulnerabilities. We are truly in, probably looking to the into the future, a world of hurt. You know, and in some despair and not knowing what else to recommend, ICS CERT recommended consumers and organizations, they had two bullet points: minimize network exposure for all control system devices and or systems, and ensure that they are not accessible from the internet. You know, unfortunately, their job may be to be accessible from the internet. Locate control systems, networks, and remote devices behind firewalls. Unfortunately, that won't be effective, and isolate them from the business network. And then they said, besides this, it's also advised to use virtual private networks for securely connecting your devices to cloud-based services over that network, which, again, may not be at all practical due to the nature, the embedded nature of these things. So, you know, we talked last week about the dangers inherent in having a technological monoculture. You know, at that point, we were talking about Chromium and the Blaze browser, I think. And of course, they'd switched to Chromium too. Here, we have a highly defective, very vulnerable TCP/IP networking library that has been on the market for more than 20 years, more than two decades. It is riddled with just discovered critical vulnerabilities of varying degrees of severity from 10.0, many of them, down. And there is just no way to update most of the affected devices. You know, for those that are recently released that are still in a maintenance contract or a maintenance loop, maybe they've got self-updating facilities, but lots of embedded things don't. We have said till we're blue in the face how crucial it is that anything that is connecting these days have a means of updating itself, because that's the only way to get the job done. And most users will, you know, who are not listening to this podcast will never even be aware that anything like this has happened. And even those of us who are privy to this podcast may not know what TCP/IP stack random embedded things have. You know, do our netcams have that? Maybe, probably, maybe not. Who knows? I mean, this is an internal library compiled into the ROM and in these devices. They may not even be updatable at that level. And yet, all of these networks and the network security we're all depending upon has arguably just taken probably a noticeable hit. And you can absolutely bet that state level and other hackers for hire are rubbing their hands together. And I'm sure that lists of affected hardware is being assembled at the moment. And it may be that people will just send test pings or test UDP, fragmented UDP at stuff and see if it crashes. If it does, it's probably got this Trek firmware down in its internals. The internet is already a target-rich environment, and it just got a whole lot richer.
It's interesting that a number of these vulnerabilities are mishandling of length variables.
Yes.
Others are not sanitizing input. It's almost the same problem as with the neck gears. It's, you know, it's...
Yep. Classic.
How did this go undetected for so long?
Yeah, that's
it's not open source. That's part of the problem, right? So nobody...
Correct.
And it's embedded, so probably nobody was testing it. Nobody.
Yeah, I think that it worked. I mean, right. and that's just it. Some engineer somewhere said, oh, look, this, you know, like it works. And, you know, I'm done. My problem has been solved.
Yeah.
Because my boss said we needed to hook this to the internet.
Gosh.
So, yay.
Golly. Just amazing. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
All right, Steve, there we go. Once again, you've made me all excited about the future of the internet. this one's not going to get fixed, period. Period.
No, it's
These
not.
These are embedded
it's
devices.
Just too, it's everywhere. It's yeah. too widespread. It's in our printers and in our light bulbs.
Wow. Now, you mentioned using a VPN to connect your IoT devices.
Well, no, that was just CERT saying.
That's a good idea either.
Yeah, that's right. Put your light bulb on a VPN. That'll work.
It's no. All right. Oh, how depressing is this? What could you do? What would the mitigation be? Since we don't know which of our many, many, many devices with embedded TCP stacks are vulnerable.
The only practical thing you could do would be to create a purpose-specific filter like in a router. So if your router would have to be trained about never accepting fragmented UDP. There have been other UDP fragmentation attacks. And there you could argue that there isn't a good reason for UDP to be fragmented nearly as much as it once was. So... you could just say drop any UDP packet with the frag bit set in its header. And so that would immediately protect you from some of these vulnerabilities. And so you could go through and, you know, carefully develop. And I imagine that some of the big IDS vendor guys are probably going to do that. They're going to add filters to protect their clients' internal networks from anybody sending this stuff from the outside. But as the device just raw plugged into the internet, I don't think there's any way to, you know, I mean, it's just not going to get its firmware updated.
God. That's so depressing. That's so depressing. Well, thank you, Steve, for cheering me up anyway. What are you going to do? It's good. I mean, we got to know this stuff, right? That's why the disclosure happens.
Forewarned.
Yeah. Steve Gibson's at GRC.com. That's where you'll find him and this show and 16 kilobit versions of the audio, which is wild. I don't know who's downloading those. Do people download those every week?
Yeah.
Have you checked?
They do.
Yeah? Wow.
Yeah.
Somebody wants them. They sound like Thomas Edison on his cylinder, his first recorder. But they're there. You can understand them. You can also get 64 kilobit audio, which sounds normal. You can also get, and this is maybe the most valuable version, well, as normal as we get, you can also get a beautifully crafted transcript by Elaine Ferris, so you can read along as you listen. We have audio and video at our site, twit.tv/SN. By the way, when you're at grc.com getting all that stuff, read all the other things there that's fun, and pick up a copy of SpinRite. If you get version 6, you'll get version 6.1 the minute it's available. You also get to participate in the beta tests, and you can already see Steve's like NASA. All that research spins off into useful products. You know, it just spins off. So you'll be part of the spin-off. Just go to grc.com, pick up Spin Right, and then you can spin off. Our site is twit.tv/SN. It's also on YouTube. Best thing to do, subscribe in your favorite podcast application. You'll get it automatically. Overcast, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, Slacker, Podcast Republic. I mean, go on and on. You know what I'm talking about. Find the show, subscribe. You'll get it every week the minute it's available. We do the show every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Watch it live as we produce it, twit.tv/live or listen live. And you can also chat if you're listening live at irc.twit.tv. After the fact, our Twit community is open, as is Steve's forums. Steve's forums are at grc.com. Ours is at twit.community. Thank you, Steve. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks,
on Security
buddy.
Now.
Righto.
Hey, folks. I am Micah Sargent, co-host of Tech News Weekly right here on the Twit Network. Yes, Tech News Weekly is a show we do every week, Jason Howell and myself, where we talk to people who are making and a breaking the tech news. That's right. It's journalists, it's inventors, it's app makers, it's everybody who's bringing the tech news in a given week. It's all the stuff you want to know about in bite-sized chunks in a fantastic package. So be sure to subscribe. It's twit.tv/TNW. Security.